someone that we felt safe with, someone that we've opened up to. The great American civil rights activist, Malcolm X, expressed something of the depth of betrayal, the feeling of it. He said, to me, the thing that is worse than death is betrayal. To me, the thing that's worse than death is betrayal. Worse than death. And he explains why. He carried on and he said, you see, I could conceive death, but I could not conceive betrayal. It's unthinkable when someone betrays you, and hugely painful. That's why we use the term backstabbing to describe it. Have you ever been betrayed? Have you ever betrayed someone close to you? You might have heard the note of betrayal in our reading from John's Gospel. In fact, it's been a bit of a theme. Last week, back in verse 2 of the same chapter, we heard about Judas who betrayed him. Judas betrayed his friend, Jesus, to the authorities and led them to him. He used the inside knowledge he had and Jesus' trust that he'd put in him to betray him. But in the passage we just heard, there's a big theme of betrayal as well. It has three scenes in it, this passage we just heard. It's got one by a fire, and then the next moves inside to an interrogation room, and then the third moves back outside to the fire. So we're going to follow that through and see the significant betrayal. And it's a betrayal that turns out to be rather uncomfortably close to home if we're prepared to accept that. So as we get into it, we will notice it doesn't start out quite so bad. It actually starts quite promisingly. See, as Jesus is being led away after he was arrested, then in verse 15, Simon Peter and another disciple were following Jesus. And that's good. Following Jesus is exactly what a disciple's supposed to do. Disciples follow Jesus. So that's a great start. Then we see in verses 15 to 16 that Peter couldn't get in to the place where Jesus was taken, the courtyard of the high priest. He couldn't get in, but the other disciple that was with him had some contacts. So he got Peter let in. But that is where the problems start. As Peter comes in the door of the courtyard, the servant girl who let him in asks this, verse 17, you aren't one of this man's disciples too, are you? I wonder if you feel that. Do you feel the pressure at that point? It's a real pressure situation. Peter just got led into the courtyard, which belongs to the man who had Jesus arrested. And during the arrest, Peter had attacked one of the guards with a sword. So Peter was closely associated with a man who'd been arrested, and he himself had done something potentially incriminating. I wonder if you know that feeling when you've done something, you know that it could get you in trouble. If someone finds out about this, you think, if they realize that this is me, there's an almost instinctual drive to just avoid getting found out. Which probably explains why Peter was sort of following Jesus at a bit of a distance. One commentator said he was following out of love, but at a distance out of fear. He wanted to follow Jesus, which was good and right, but now came the test. As the servant girl asks him directly if he is one of this man, Jesus' disciples. And his answer, end of verse 17, he replied, I am not. And there it is. He's taken the step. He let the fear overcome him. He sought his own good and started to betray Jesus. Because that's exactly what this is. Even at the end of the day, with all the pressure, all the difficulty, it was a hard situation. It's still betrayal. He still distanced himself from his friend and his leader and his Lord in order to save himself from trouble. It's interesting what happens next. It's where the fire comes in. Look at verse 18. It was cold, and the servants and officials stood around a fire they had made to keep warm. Now, these are servants and officials of the high priest. In fact, that word officials is the same word used back in verse 3 and verse 12 to describe the temple police who came to arrest Jesus. We saw that last week. So these servants and officials are the very people who came to arrest Jesus. And they're doing two things. They're standing around and warming themselves. And in verse 17, we see Peter, we see Peter was doing, it can't be right, no, verse 17, I'm going to look at the verse. So in verse 18, yes, we see the end of verse 18, we see that Peter was doing exactly the same two things. Peter was standing with them, warming himself. Here are these officials standing, warming themselves, and here's Peter. The gospel writer makes sure we see, standing with them, warming himself. The gospel writer, in his very rich way, is telling us something here that Peter is standing with, being identified with those who had arrested Jesus. Those who were against Jesus. Where you stand makes a difference. There was a movie I was watching just yesterday, a kids' movie with my kids, that it was called The House of Magic, and there's a point where there's this little cat, and it's a kid movie, so the cat talks, and then there's these toys that move because it's a kids' movie, and so the cat, all the toys are against the cat, and a rabbit and a mouse as well. They're all against the cat. And one of the toys, who the cat helped out, walks across and stands next to the cat to say, no, I'm with the cat. See, where you stand says something about who you're with, who you're in favor of. Peter is standing on the wrong side here. He's with those who are against Jesus. And that's a picture of what started to happen inside him. He's begun to betray Jesus, to deny Jesus. Do you know what that's like? Being on the wrong side of Jesus? On the other side from Jesus? I'm not asking the person next to you, by the way. I'm asking if you know. There might be issues or times where you actually realize you're standing on the other side from Jesus. On the other side from where Jesus is on this issue or in this area. Maybe that's something worth giving some thought and prayer to this week, all of us. Does it ever cross your mind that you might be standing on the other side from Jesus sometimes, standing against him on some issue or another, holding opinions contrary to his? Or in some area of your life where you just won't take his side. You know what his side is, but you stay opposed to him. You warm yourself by the fire. You keep that area of your life closed up to him rather than taking the hard step of standing with him on whatever the issue is and whatever the area of your life is. I know that's me sometimes. We're going to think more on that area later. But now the gospel writer changes scenes and we move into the interrogation room. Verse 19. Meanwhile, the high priest questioned Jesus about his disciples and his teaching. Just to clear up one possible little tangle, stay with me here, just one possible little tangle as we start. There are sort of two high priests, there's a bit of history here, sort of two high priests mentioned in this part of John's Gospel. One is Caiaphas, who we heard last week was the high priest at the time. He was the guy who said that better that one person dies for the people, Caiaphas. But there was also his father-in-law, Annas. Now, Annas wasn't actually the high priest technically at this time anymore. He'd been the high priest a couple of decades before. But it seems that Annas was still considered high priestly by many people, partly because it was the Romans who'd taken him out from being high priest, and a lot of the Jews thought that the Romans had no right to do such a thing. And also partly because Annas's family was full of high priests. Five of his sons, plus a son-in-law, Caiaphas, and a grandson, all ended up being high priests in the first century. So he was like the high priestly godfather, no pun intended. This man was sort of a high priest godfather. And The man called the high priest in the part of the scriptures we're looking at today is Annas. So Caiaphas is Annas, the godfather guy. And Annas asked Jesus these two questions about his disciples and his teaching. And Jesus, first of all, answers about his teaching. He says in verse 20 and 21, he's spoken openly. He hasn't concealed anything. That the soldiers and authorities have basically arrested him for being some kind of dangerous revolutionary, and they think that he must be plotting and teaching dangerous things in some corner secretly. But he says, I spoke openly. In the synagogues, in the temple, in the public places where everyone gathers, I spoke there. Lots of people heard him, he says. There were plenty of witnesses. Ask them about it. And one of the officials, those temple police, again, one of them slapped him and said, is this the way you answer the high priest? See, this official was accusing Jesus of being disrespectful, of being insulting. And so he insults Jesus painfully with a slap. But Jesus won't back down. Verse 23. If I said something wrong, testify as to what is wrong. But if I spoke the truth, why did you strike me? Again, Jesus is being upfront here. I'm not hiding anything. Give me a fair trial. Tell me what I've done wrong. Bring the witnesses. It's obvious why Jesus can say this. Because he is completely innocent. He is the innocent one. Any of us standing before a judge at an interrogation, we'd be aware of something we've done wrong. It's funny, isn't it, when you see a police car go past and suddenly you, what am I doing wrong? Because we know we've done some things wrong. Even we might not be speeding, might be going 45. But we just feel like there's something we've done wrong because there's a police car. Because we know we have done things wrong. I wonder when I talked earlier about that feeling of knowing that you'd done something and being worried about being caught, that maybe someone would find out. Did you know that feeling? I certainly do. There's a story that the author of Sherlock Holmes, Arthur Conan Doyle, sent a prank message to 12 upstanding people where he said, all is discovered, flee immediately. And the next morning they were gone. Now, I did a bit of looking into that story, and it's one of those things that's really hard to work out whether it's true or not. Arthur Conan Doyle seems to have liked telling stories and maybe been quite good at telling stories, you can tell with Sherlock Holmes, but also in other ways. It's hard to know whether it's true, but the reason that it sounds like it could be true to us is precisely because we know we all have skeletons in our closet. And if anyone found out about them, we would be horrified, be running for cover. We've got things to hide. Jesus has nothing to hide. Nothing. Peter himself, one of Jesus' closest friends, wrote some years later about Jesus, words that always astound me every time I hear them. He committed no sin and no deceit was found in his mouth. It's a quote from the Old Testament applied directly to Jesus by one of Jesus' closest friends. After spending 3 years living closely with Jesus, Peter could say that about him. No deceit, no sin. Could your closest friend, your spouse, your kids, your parents, could they say that about you after 3 minutes? No, couldn't say about me after 3 minutes. After 3 years, Peter said that about Jesus. Jesus was the innocent one. So he says, all I've done has been in public. Find someone to show what I've done wrong. And Annas seems to be stymied by this. Verse 24, he just sends him on to Caiaphas. Can't find anything wrong. Jesus is the innocent one. But I want us to notice one other thing about this innocent one. He's innocent, but he's not self-protecting. Let me show you what I mean. Back in verse 19, what was it that Annas asked him about? Two things. What was it? His disciples and his teaching. Jesus answered about his teaching, but he said nothing about his disciples. Did you notice? And even more than that, at the start of verse 20, did you notice how he starts every sentence? Jesus starts every sentence, "I've spoken openly. I always taught in the synagogues. I said nothing in secret." He's putting all the focus on himself. And sometimes when people do that, you know, that's not so good. But in this case, he's putting it on himself to keep the focus off his disciples. This is just like last week, we saw it in verse 8, where he said, "If I'm the one you're looking for, let these men go." He's protecting his disciples. He's protecting them. And he's protecting, that means, Peter. Remember, Jesus knew that Peter would deny him. Way back in chapter 13, Jesus had said that his disciples couldn't follow him where he was going straight away. And Peter asked, "Lord, why can't I follow you now? I will lay down my life for you." And Jesus answered, "Will you really lay down your life for me? Very truly I tell you, before the rooster crows, you will disown me three times." See, Jesus knew exactly what Peter would do, that Peter would deny him, betray him. But even as Peter is betraying him at this very moment, Jesus is protecting Peter. The innocent one is protecting the one who denies him. At that point, we switch back to the scene by the fire. And straight away, verse 25, again, the gospel writer points out that Peter's standing with those opposed to Jesus. And immediately, someone else asks Peter, "You aren't one of the disciples too, are you?" And Peter's at a crisis point again. But he's already denied Jesus once. You notice how easy it is to get into a habit of doing that, over and again, saying no and denying Jesus. And so Peter says, "I am not." In verse 26, one of the high priest's servants sees him. And here's danger, because this man was a relative of Malchus, a relative of the man that Peter had cut off his ear. So a relative of that man who's had his ear cut off just earlier that night, just some hours ago. And Peter's got the pressure again. Will he acknowledge his connection with Jesus and risk serious trouble? He may have to face the consequences of attacking Malchus, of injuring Malchus. Acknowledging Jesus actually often means for us that we need to own up to things that we've done and face the consequences in an earthly sense. But even if he didn't have to face those consequences, even if he got away with that, he'd certainly have to be identified with this fugitive, this man that was looked down on, this dangerous and foolish man that everyone thought was dangerous and foolish, Jesus. Peter would have to say, "Yes, I am one of his." Will he do it? Verse 27, again, Peter denied it. And right at that moment, the rooster began to crow. Just as Jesus had said, "Before the rooster crows, you'll deny me three times." So he did. Sometimes our failures feel almost inevitable. But yet Peter had been so sure of himself, hadn't he? "I'll go with you, Lord." But here he was, a denier. At the very moment that Jesus was protecting him, being slapped and accused and yet not giving him up, protecting him, at that very moment, Peter was acting as if Jesus didn't exist and as if he didn't even know him. Peter was not ready to suffer for the one who was going to suffer for him. I wonder if you identify with Peter yet. We need to be realistic about this, about where we deny Jesus. And if you're sitting there thinking, "I don't deny Jesus," then I guarantee you're not being realistic. There's no use in pretending away our denials. Peter was pretending. Look where it got him. Besides, just like with Peter, Jesus knows. He knows what goes on in our hearts, what comes out of our mouths, what we do with our hands and feet. So where do you and I deny Jesus? Obviously, there's the connection with this passage of our public lives. Are we known publicly as Christians? I mean, do people at work, at school, at the kids' school, at your place of study, your neighbours, at the clubs you belong to, do they know that you belong to Jesus? I don't mean, are you obnoxiously loud about it and condemning people and being Bible basher and saying tut tut all the time and so they know you're a Christian and they run for cover? I don't mean that. That's just being obnoxious. What I mean simply is this. Have you been honest about it? Have you taken the chances to quietly or in whatever way let people know that you belong to Jesus? Let people you know that belong to Jesus is the most wonderful thing. Like when someone asks you what you did on the weekend, does church ever make it into the description? Into your response? Because it's an easy way to drop a hint. When you talk about some issue, do you ever consciously answer as a Christian? Again, not holier than thou or anything like that, but just saying, well, as a follower of Jesus, I think such and such. And let me ask, if people don't know you're a Christian, why is that? Is it because you don't want to be identified with Jesus? I know myself that I have denied him in that kind of way many times. Missed opportunities that I know I should have taken to be identified with Jesus, to say, I belong to him. Or to say, no, on this issue, I have to side with Jesus. And sometimes that will be messy. People might automatically associate you with being a fundamentalist, or you might have to try to explain what you don't mean and what you do mean, and that's tricky. You might get laughed at, scoffed at. But so often I at least know that in trying to avoid that, I'm denying Jesus. I was baptized when I was 19. Didn't grow up Christian. But do you know, I didn't even tell my mum about my baptism service. Not even my mum. I think I was embarrassed of Jesus. I haven't entirely gotten over that sort of thing, unfortunately. Might sound odd being a minister, but it's true. I wonder if you know that sense of denying Jesus out of just not wanting to be too closely associated with him. Of course, there is another way, not quite as direct, but I still think true, where we deny Jesus by our actions. Whenever I want to do something that I know he doesn't want me to do, but I pretend that he isn't really there or he won't really be bothered about it, and I pretend that so that I can do what I want to do even if he doesn't want me to, surely at that point I'm denying him. I'm denying his lordship over my life, his right to say what I should and shouldn't do. I'm denying that he really knows what's best for me. I'm denying that I belong to him. I'm denying that I know him by my actions. Maybe you know that too. Some may be here thinking, well, I don't do that because I don't follow Jesus. And this is all about followers of Jesus denying him. And if you're thinking that, fair enough at one level, it's true. But I would just say this. First, I'd say it's fantastic you're here. I'm really excited you're here. Second, I'd say this. Jesus calls on every single person to acknowledge him as Lord. Every person to acknowledge him as Lord and as King. And so to not do that, to not accept him as your King, to not follow him, is to deny him. I only became a Christian, as I said, when I was 19. And I know for an absolute fact that a reason that it took me so long was that I was so worried about what other people would think. I'd been interested in Jesus since I started hearing about him at Bible and schools. And all through my teenage years, I was kind of interested. But I was a musician. I didn't want people thinking I was one of these Jesus freaks. and I didn't want to take the risk of looking into him. I didn't want to risk going to a church or to risk taking him seriously. Please don't let that be you. You're here. That's a great start. But don't let that fear of what others think get in the way of really seeking him out. It's what happened with Peter. Worried about what the others would think, what might happen. Don't let that be you. Please talk to me or someone else here if you want to know more about that. Because the thing is, we are all deniers standing by the fire. And the last thing I want to talk about, perhaps quite scarily then, is death for deniers. I don't mean death to deniers. I don't mean death for denying Jesus. Although, actually, he's the king of the universe. It's a pretty serious thing to deny him. But what I mean is death for deniers. Jesus' protection of Peter was just the start. It was the start of the interrogation that led to the trial, that led to the sentence, that led to a humiliating and torturous death on a cross. And that's where Jesus was going. And he was going there to protect us, deniers, to protect and save us from the rightful wrath and punishment we deserve because we deny him. And at the very time that we denied him, he died for us. We denied him, and at that very time he died for us. You will have, like me, in any number of ways, denied this one who loved you so much. And yet it's at that precise point, for that very reason, that he died for you. That's his love. The one who knew he would be denied still went and died for those who denied him, for you and I. And is there any greater motivation to stop denying him than that? Is there any greater reason to start acknowledging him as Lord, publicly, privately, in words and actions and thoughts? How can we go on denying one who loves us so much? Isn't your heart filled with the desire to honor him? To stand up for him? To say, yes, so help me God, I belong to him. As a church, no matter what it costs us, no matter what difficulties we might face, can we really deny this one? Even if we have to stand up against culture, even if we come into clash with the structures around us, can we deny this Lord? We balk at the idea of denying someone close to us, someone dear to us, someone who has looked after us, cared for us. If we do that, that's why family loyalty is so important. The idea of being disloyal just seems so wrong. How much more is it cosmically wrong to deny this Lord who has done this for us? How much more should we be inspired to own him, the one who loved us and died for us, though he was perfectly innocent? Can we really deny him? No, because he never denied us, even when it was at the cost of his death. Let me pray. Lord Jesus, you did not deny us, even when it cost you everything. You went to your death for us who denied you. Give us strength then not to deny you any longer. In whatever ways we do deny you, strengthen us to stand with you. We can't do it on our own, so we entrust ourselves to your strength, and we thank you for your great mercy, because it was for us who deny you that you died so we could be yours. Thank you. Amen.